Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It is a Wednesday. Neighbors in Action later this hour. That is synonymous with Wednesday here on our program. We'll also hear about a local production of Dracula here, just in time for Halloween. And we talk juvenile justice reform later this hour with a couple of key figures in reforming how Michigan addresses juvenile justice and juvenile offenders. Kristen Staley of the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency joins Senator Rick Jones and me here in about 30 minutes or so. And it's Archaeology Day on Saturday, I believe. That is always fun. We'll have a report on that from Kevin Lavery before the hour is through. I'm Mark Bayshore. The Lansing School District is considering a bond proposal in 2016 that would raise over $100 million. The so-called Pathway Promise proposal includes lots of building renovations, along with moving Eastern High School to the current Pattengill Academy with a new gymnasium and lab spaces among the highlights. Over the last couple of weeks, district officials have conducted five public forums to gather input on the proposal and what passage or failure might mean to the district. Joining us to discuss the plan in more detail and the response to it so far, Peter Spadafor, president of the Lansing Board of Education. Welcome back, Peter.
Thank you.
We were hoping to have Yvonne Kamal Kanul join us as well, the Lansing School District Superintendent. We're led to believe she's been under the weather yesterday and presumably today as well. So you and I will stir this up. Let's outline the current plan here. I touched on a couple of features. It would raise $120 million, and it includes a lot of building renovations. The move of Eastern High School to Pattengill, a new gymnasium and lab spaces. What are we leaving out of that description?
Well, also, in addition to that, it's about $120 million overall cost. It's about a $3 per month increase for the average homeowner in the city. So for, you know, the price of a cup of coffee a month, we're talking about an investment that will have an impact on every student in the Lansing School District. We're looking at over $30 million in general renovations to include new furniture, refreshed classroom space, energy efficiencies, those types of things throughout the district. So it's over 25 school buildings will see some sort of renovation that touches every ward in the city, every corner of our community. So we're very excited about what this means for every student. This is not just a one building or two building plan like some bond proposals have been in the past. This is a plan that really looks at our academic need throughout the district and then spends the appropriate amount of money to make sure that's a reality.
Well, let's clarify, though, because I'm reading that the new millage would cost the owner of a home with a taxable value of $50,000 an extra $112 annually. You alluded to an average $3 cost. Do we have this right? Is the 112 figure wrong?
That is the total cost of the millage. The increase is about $3 per month because what's happening is we're utilizing the expiration of our sinking fund, which currently levies dollars that we use on short-term projects like a new boiler or a new roof or an emergency repair or new parking lots, those types of things.
So you extend the current sinking fund, and it boils down to an average $3 a year increase for the average homeowner.
It's a little complicated, but what happens is when the sinking fund expires, rather than renewing the sinking fund, following me so far?
Okay, I think so.
We roll it into a millage, and then we increase by 0.75 mils. That allows us to raise $120 million over a long period of time, rather than about $4 million annually on the sinking fund.
But the net increase for the average homeowner, you say,
is about $3 a month.
Okay. Appreciate the context here. Talk about the Eastern High School move. Sparrow Hospital wants to buy the existing school. How likely is that, and how much might it bring to the district?
Currently, the district is negotiating a proposal with Sparrow Hospital for about $2.5 million for that site and around 18 acres surrounding the Eastern High School property. That will come before the board in the next few weeks for approval. So I would say pretty likely. We had it pass the board 8-1 already, so I think we'll see a strong show of support if that final proposal makes it to the board in the next few weeks. That proposal gives us 5 years to live in that space rent-free. Obviously, we have to take care of it and pay our utility bills, but Sparrow has generously offered up to 5 years for us to stay there while we prepare new space for the students who are currently there. So when the bond passes and we begin renovations over at Patton Gill Middle School to turn that into Eastern High School, the students will have some time to get used to that transition. We'll have time as a district to make that transition very seamless.
Mm-hmm. The costs associated with this, obviously, we did our best to clarify how this plays out here just a minute ago. Does this require an awful lot of clarification to the people in at the public gatherings that you've had so far? Obviously, the cost has got to be front and center.
Well, the one thing that I've heard that struck me was folks at these community forums, where we heard from almost 100 people across the city, was, okay, let's do this, but please explain how it works. So what we're going to try and do then is clarify how all the moving parts will work over the next few months. We have until May, when the vote will take place, to tell that story and really help people understand the Pathway Promise proposal. So I think the costs are something that people will be concerned with. Where is this money going? How is it going to be spent?
What happens in May, though?
That's
the decision
the
whether or not... Oh, okay. The vote is in May?
Yes.
Okay. The vote is in May. Very good. Part of the Pathway Promise is creation of specific paths for students. Can you detail what some of those paths would entail?
Yeah, we're looking at trying to specialize learning in those environments so that if you want to go into the biotechnology area after your time at the Lansing School District, you've got extra support for that area. If you want to go into science, technology, engineering and mathematics, or STEM, you've got extra support in those areas. Or the International Baccalaureate Program, you've got a path that is clearly defined. What we're doing with the Pathway Promise is, rather than saying you will go to this school because you live near this school, we're saying you have to choose where you'd like to go based on what your academic goals are. And it's a decision that's going to have to be made with parents and students in consultation with the school district. Certainly every district building will offer general education, so you don't have to worry about not getting the basics, you know, the reading, the writing, and the arithmetic, those types of things. But if you're interested in the arts, we've got a place for you. Mm. It really gives students choice. I view it kind of like picking your college major. You know, you don't have to do it on day one, but you get the opportunity to specialize in something that you will be an expert in by the end of your time.
We're talking about the Lansing School District's Pathway Promise plan to raise $120 million with School Board President Peter Spatafor. How are parents responding to this pathway concept?
So far, they're pretty excited about it. I think it's the first time in a long time that we've clearly spelled out, you know, a start to finish guide for the district. So regardless of the bond, they're very excited about the Lansing Pathway Promise. Now, there are some concerns, you know, what happens if I want to switch during a pathway,
yeah,
those types
what about
of things.
That?
It's entirely possible. We're far from implementation right now, but we're working on those types of answers as well as how do you navigate those pathways. One of the things we've talked about with the superintendent is sort of dedicated staff members throughout the district who are pathway navigators to help parents and students, you know, go through this process seamlessly and make sure they're getting what they need out of the school district.
Tell us more about the feedback from voters and parents at these five public forums held last week and on Monday. Do you feel, are you hearing support? Are you hearing a lot of reticence or skepticism? What?
I'm not hearing reticence or skepticism. I'm hearing support, but we're also hearing a lot of concern that we do this carefully and that we do this with a lot of purpose. So they want to make sure that whatever we do with the Pathway Promise and the buildings, that we implement it carefully, that we make sure our staff are trained in our new way of thinking, that we make sure that the students get what they need and that we don't leave anyone behind. So I think there's support for what we're trying to do. There's just a little cautious optimism that we do it correctly. Mm-hmm. So it's our job to make sure we do it correctly and that we tell the story of how that's being done.
How much could you conceivably tweak the proposal between now and next May, depending on the feedback that
well,
you get?
Well, tweaking the Pathway Promise is a lot easier because we can – it's an academic program. When we start talking about asking for dollars and cents to make a construction project, what goes on the ballot is very important that we stick to that. So we're going to have to make sure that, you know, if we've said we're going to build – a new cafeteria at Everett, that we stick to that script, you know, those types of things. That's enforced by state laws and things like that. So that's a little different. But the Pathway Promise, let's say, you know, in 3 years, we just have determined that we need to put more support into one of the pathways than we did the others. We can do that. If we want to do that between now and May, we can do that.
Today's a big day at school districts around Michigan. It's count day. State funding of schools hinging on the results. More than 3,000 kids, Lansing kids, attend other schools. What's your feeling about count day, and what is Lansing doing about increasing attendance in the district?
Well, we are very anxious to see the count day results from today. Today is our late start Wednesday, so folks had a little bit more time to sleep in if they wanted to, if they were thinking about not coming to school. So if you're still
at home,
where
Yvonne is,
yeah,
probably.
That's probably right. If you're thinking about coming to school and you haven't yet, please make sure you make it. But it's very important to us. You know, the count day concept is probably one of the only ways we can fund our schools the way the system is set up. But we educate a lot of students that might not be here today for absences or family emergencies, those types of things. So we have some time to make up those numbers, but it's very important that students attend on count day because so much of our funding is dependent upon the fall count day. 90% of our blended count comes from the fall count. And that's very important to the Lansing School District because if we lose students, every student is over $7,000 that is not computed. And that's a big amount of money. You're talking those 3,000. We figure that's about $22 million of revenue that's no longer in the district.
Yeah. Lansing Board of Education President Peter Spadafore, we've been talking about the Pathway Promise and attendance in the Lansing School Districts. Peter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Well, October is upon us, and you can see an uptick in the number of pumpkins and spooky decorations around mid-Michigan. The Andromeda Community Theater in Charlotte is getting in the mood of the season by staging the classic Bram Stoker tale Dracula. For the next couple of weekends, current state's Jamie Paisley is with me now and attended one of the troupe's final rehearsals. I take it the performance will not be on a traditional theater or stage. Is that correct, Jamie?
Yeah, that's right. For this very different count day, it is going to be a performance at the Country Mill, that apple orchard and cider mill just off of I-69 to the north of Charlotte. And according to director Andrew Hipkiss, this Dracula production will be utilizing some of the current haunted house display currently found at the Country Mill. However, this isn't the first non-traditional staging that they've put on. The Andromeda Theater's most recent production of To Kill a Mockingbird took place in a rather historic Charlotte courthouse as well. And regarding this upcoming Dracula staging, I also spoke with the Vlad himself, Eric DeLongchamp, about how he prepped for his Dracula audition.
Basically, once he said after Kill a Mockingbird that they might be doing Dracula, I was reading books out loud and talking in that accent, or trying to. I'm not sure if I get it good, but it's good enough for them, I guess.
Since the Country Mill is also a working business, the cast of Dracula has been utilizing the Windwalker Gallery in downtown Charlotte as a rehearsal space. And the timing of the rehearsals merged very well with a certain celestial event that happened at the end of September.
We had rehearsal, and then one of the people from Windwalker, he had this idea that I should get pictures of me and then some other people in the cast too when they had the blood moon. And so after rehearsal, we had like a group photo and that was okay. But the problem was the clouds kind of covered the moon a bit. And so we had a hard time. As the eclipse was beginning, we couldn't really see it. But then I'd say about either midway to three quarters of the way through the eclipse and the clouds broke a little bit. And that was when the moon was red. And when the moon was red, it worked out really well. And so I was on the roof and I was standing on the corner. Vince was taking the shots. He was taking them out in the street down in the Cochrane, which is like the main street of Charlotte. He's looking up and there's me as Dracula standing in the corner of the roof. And then, I don't know, there's some people driving by. I don't know if too many people noticed, but the cops were sort of like checking us out. They didn't do anything, but, you know, they were curious as to why there's someone standing on the roof. Is he going to jump, whatever? But I saw one that looked like the same one come around a second time. So I was like, well, maybe, you know, which is kind of funny. Not funny at the same time.
And as the supernatural character of Dracula, Eric DeLongchamp had to deal with several additional theatrical special effects to his characterization.
That was, for me, it was the more difficult part of it, because I was just thinking I was just going to be acting and saying my lines and being menacing generally and not doing much else. And then there's other things they wanted me to do, and I had to learn new skills and on the fly, and hopefully it works out.
On the fly as in you're also flying?
Well, no, not like that. We're not going that far. That would, good thing you didn't have the interview earlier. They might try to do that. They've been making me jump through some weird hoops, but.
Are you from Charlotte?
Not really. I mean, I'm from here now. I moved here from Ishpeming, Michigan in the UP back in April of 2014. There isn't very much work up there. Basically, I moved here for work.
Right. And so 2014 means that you kind of meshed very well with the startup of Andromeda Theater as well.
Yeah, it was sort of, it just worked out, I guess, because I had no idea about anything. And then I saw a poster like the day before they were going to do tryouts for It's a Wonderful Life. And I was like, well, I'll just try it, because I always wanted to do theater before, but there was other things in my life that sort of got in the way. I mean, I did a little bit in high school, but, you know, most, I sort of amp up my experience when I'm writing like in applications, but really it wasn't that much.
And then when you were cast, how did you celebrate?
Well, how did I celebrate? Well, at first, I sort of was thinking about how I should go about doing the role. And when I told people I was Dracula, everyone had all sorts of advice. They were telling me to watch lots of vampire movies. And then this one, Ina Phelps, who's with the troupe, was telling me to watch movies with people playing Slavic people, because she's from Russia. And even though Dracula is not technically Slavic, Eastern European, it's pretty close. And so she was giving me some advice for that. But most of what I did for the Dracula is something I sort of got from within myself. I think that's the strongest inspiration. And then the stuff that's outside will help you. But really, the best part of acting is stuff that comes from within, I think.
So different from my own Transylvania, with so few people and so little opportunity.
He's taken his role very, very seriously. And, of course, that's what we'd like to see. My name is Andrew Hipkiss. I'm the resident director of Andromeda Community Theater here in Charlotte, Michigan. When we determined that we wanted to do a show with a Halloween theme, we knew that the Country Mill was a natural fit, because they have so many different activities that go along with the Halloween season, including they have a haunted hayride, and they have a haunted house. In fact, the space that we're sharing with the haunted house. So again, that explains some of the logistical problems that we had in terms of availability. But we worked it all out, and we figured it'd be a great cross-promotional thing for them and us. And they've been very, very accommodating, and something, again, you know, hopefully we can continue, you know, in the years to come.
Oh, that must be Van Helsing. You go on ahead. I'll be along presently.
Should one expect a lot of audience interaction?
I would hope so. I mean, this is a fun play. It's a melodrama. So there's moments of, you know, big scares, but there's also lighter moments as well. And yeah, of course, we'd encourage audience participation. We're hoping that people dress for the show and, you know, as many as we can get in and just have a good time with it.
And what kind of special effects would people be expecting to see?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, of course, but there will be what I consider to be some pretty neat special effects, both with lighting and other things. And I don't think the audience will be disappointed in that aspect of the show by any means.
There they are again. Every dog for a mile around.
And then how many people are in the show in total?
We wrote in a couple additional roles. We played around with the script a little bit, and we wanted to do some things just to add to the story. So we added three or four non-speaking roles. And again, I don't want to give any more than that away. However, there are eight principal roles. So it is a small cast, and this is the first time that we've done a small cast show. Up until this time, the shows we did were Wonderful Life, which is, well, I think we had 30 people in that show on stage. And then To Kill a Mockingbird, which with the extras and so on, the jurors we did up at the courthouse here in Charlotte, that I think we were in the 20s with that cast too. So this is our first time experimenting, if you will, with a smaller cast.
You'll have to bring your own capes and fangs to the Andromeda Community Theater's production of Dracula, taking place Thursday through Saturday, October 8th through the 10th, as well as the following week, the 15th through the 17th. The show takes place at the Country Mill off of Otto Road in North Charlotte. Tickets and more information can be found at andromedaplayers.org.
All right, let's clear the set and get ready to run Act 1, please.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Pease.
Coming up on Current State, there's been increasing scrutiny recently of how Michigan treats juveniles who are tried and convicted as adults. A bipartisan coalition of Michigan lawmakers is now proposing big changes. We talked to State Senator Rick Jones, one of the sponsors of the legislation, as well as Kristen Staley of the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. We welcome your questions for our guests as well. Email us, currentstate@wkar.org, on Twitter, @KARCurrentState, or on Facebook. Plus, history buffs, break out your pickaxes. Michigan Archaeology Day is coming. We'll talk about it coming up. That and more after the break on Current State. Speaking of vampires and the like, Stephanie Meyer, who you recognize as the author of the four books in the original Twilight series, has announced that she's written a new version of the story, but this one comes with a twist. This, according to USA Today, Edward and Bella are now Edith and Beau. In Life and Death, Twilight Reimagined, the gender of the two main characters has been swapped to become the story of a female vampire and the human teenage boy she falls in love with, okay? The new story is available as a bonus in the 10th anniversary edition of Twilight. Current State on WKAR, I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. In the 1990s, many states, including Michigan, implemented tougher standards for prosecuting and sentencing juvenile offenders. Those tough-on-crime policies meant more minors got passed on to the adult justice system. Prison reform advocates say that's done more harm than good when it comes to public safety. Now, a bipartisan group of lawmakers is trying to change the way the state treats offenders under the age of 18. New bills being introduced in the state legislature would overhaul Michigan's current policies. To learn more about what these bills might mean for Michigan's juvenile offenders, we welcome State Senator Rick Jones, one of the sponsors of the bill package. Senator Jones, welcome back.
Good morning.
And Kristen Staley joins us as well. Kristen's Associate Director of Youth Justice Policy for the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Welcome, Kristen.
Thanks for having me.
Some of the impetus behind this legislation came out of a report that the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency authored last year about the state's policies for juvenile offenders. We've looked into this set in several segments on this program, but briefly remind our listeners what the main takeaways were from that report.
Absolutely. We took upon the research to really understand what are the pathways of young people entering our criminal justice system, and we found, first and foremost, in the past 10 years, over 20,000 people under the age of 18 have been pushed further into our criminal justice system, whether they've been held in jails and prisons, they've been on adult probation. But the biggest fact that comes out of that, it's that 95% of those 20,000 young people are there automatically because they're age 17. This package of bills is incredibly comprehensive, but the majority of the lead sponsors on this bill are there because we're trying to bring Michigan back to where many of the other states are already existing and federal laws already exist, that we're going to allow 17-year-olds to be treated as young people. We're going to keep them out of the adult justice system. And it's Michigan's turn, frankly, to come up to best practices and up to speed with the other states.
Senator Rick Jones, what are some of the problems you see with how Michigan currently deals with juvenile offenders?
Well, I have a great deal of experience dealing with offenders, 31 years in police work, and for four of those years I was jail administrator. Certainly, there's a big problem with jail overcrowding. Whenever a 17-year-old is brought in, the administrator does everything they can to separate them from the hardcore bad people. But you can't always do that with overcrowding. So that's one problem. The other problem I see with giving a 17-year-old an adult record is that they sometimes can't get a job later in life. And when they can't get a job, they're more likely to stay in the world of crime. So that's something that I've been very concerned with over the years. In fact, I have another bill that I put in on minor in possession. to make sure that they get one chance. The first time would be a civil infraction, not a criminal infraction, because do we really want a kid not being able to get a job for possessing one beer?
Michigan spends around 20% of its general fund budget on corrections, Senator Jones. How has the question of spending and costs played into the reforms that are being proposed in these bills?
Well, I do believe that 17-year-olds would still go to prison if they committed a heinous crime. Certainly, prosecutors would take 16 and 17-year-olds and put them in the adult system if they commit murder or probably an armed robbery, something quite dangerous. But for the lesser offenses, they would be treated as a juvenile, so there probably would be some savings in that area. But I don't know that savings is really generated in this package of bills. It's more looking at, can we make this a better Michigan and make sure that young people can get jobs?
Kristen, you want to follow up on that?
Absolutely. And frankly, the senator is absolutely correct that the essence of these bills is really giving young people a chance. We found in our research that 60% of these young people are committing nonviolent offenses, and that when you house kids in with adult offenders, that when they do come out, because they do, they're only inside in prison or in jail for an average of 4 years, they're 34% more likely to reoffend sooner, and to do so much more violently than their counterparts in the juvenile justice system.
How many inmates are we talking about in the Michigan system that are there for violent versus nonviolent offenses? How does that break down?
So we're not talking about a large amount of people who are actually incarcerated in an actual prison setting. Many of these young people have experienced jail because jail is, as the senator said, is a short term, and it does lead to a lot of overcrowding. But in the prison setting, we're talking around 60 to 70 young people under the age of 18. But frankly, across the entire state, we've seen a range of numbers. While it's hard to kind of quantify, most recently around 663 young people. Most of them are on probation or on some sort of jail setting. Like I said, many of these people are committing nonviolent offenses and can be treated in the juvenile system, which is much more robust, is age-appropriate, and is dedicated to providing a broader set of options that are age-appropriate for these young kids. Mm.
Kristen Staley is Associate Director of Youth Justice Policy at the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Senator Rick Jones also joins us today. He represents Michigan's 24th District. We're talking about a package of bills proposing reforms to the way Michigan deals with juveniles in the adult justice system. Senator Jones, another proposal would prohibit placing anyone under 18 in adult prisons. Help us understand, isn't this already the practice in Michigan?
Well, not necessarily. Certainly at age 17, we have many people that go to jail. For example, shoplifting, minor in possession, possession of a joint of marijuana, things like that get young people thrown into jail. There's actually a couple of judges I'm aware of that give young people 7 days in jail for minor in possession, and that could be simply having one beer in some college campuses. You may not even possess the beer. They give you a breathalyzer while you're walking around, not driving, walking around, and charge you with MIP.
But, Kristen, isn't it true that, there's a difference between a jail and a prison here. Anyone under 18, Michigan did change paths on this a few years ago with regard to the prisons, and there's a sight and sound provision that's in play now.
Yes, absolutely. There's a federal law that's in place called the Prison Rape Elimination Act. It requires every state and every locality to separate young people who are 18, either above or below. But it does not mean that they are not still housed in these adult facilities. That's what this bill does. It takes it one step further. It prohibits the placement and the use of adult prisons or jails until they turn age 18. Now, this practice is already in place in many different counties. Depending upon the judge and the sentencing, young people who are tried as adults can receive what's called a blended sentence, where they receive a juvenile facility or juvenile treatment up until age 18. We want to strengthen that and really allow judges that option for all youth if they are to be tried as adults.
17-year-olds aren't the only minors who can be tried as adults in Michigan, as I understand it. For certain offenses, prosecutors don't even need a judge's approval to try someone under 17 as an adult. Will these packages, Kristen, change anything about that process?
Well, you're correct. There are numerous ways that a young person can be tried as an adult. Now, this package of bills, we're beginning really with focusing on the 17-year-olds. There are a few bills that kind of tweak some changes to the laws that occurred in the 1990s that where judges' hands were tied, kind of limiting their discretion, and a lot of mandates in terms of, you know, what if a crime occurs, that crime must receive an adult sentence for regardless of the person's age. There's a few package of bills here that kind of reduces those those types of offenses that we're seeing really, frankly, are not necessarily warranting as much of an adult sentence, things like a certain level drug charges or running away from a juvenile facility. And also there's a package of bills that will broaden the discretion of a judge to look at a large range of mitigating factors that allow really just showing that these are kids, and they're kids that should be judged on an individual basis, not on one size fits all.
What would you consider? Define mitigating factor for us.
Sure. Culpability, age, mental health status, if there were other co-defendants in the case. These are the types of things that a judge can look at. But currently on the books, if a young person is to be waived, and it's through what's called a traditional waiver hearing, where a judge makes the determination that this person, that the offense has been committed that's so heinous that needs to be charged as an adult, which certainly happens, that judge can look at all of these broad factors. But right now the law states that they can only look at the offense and if any other past delinquency. We want to broaden that discretion.
Rick Jones, as a former sheriff and police officer, how are you responding to concerns that these kinds of reforms would compromise public safety?
Well, I want to make sure everybody understands that I will continue to support that young people get put away for heinous crimes. But for the things that they're being put in jail for now, such as shoplifting and minor in possession and possession of one joint of marijuana, things like that, I think we have to reevaluate our system. Are we wasting taxpayer money? Could we be better spent somewhere else? And can we make sure these young people are employable when they're done with their punishment?
Now, there is bipartisan support for prison reform in Michigan, but past efforts to make changes have been met with significant opposition several times from Attorney General Bill Schuette. What are the chances of success for these proposed reforms, Senator Jones?
I think that most of the concepts would be acceptable to the Attorney General. There may be one, something there that he's not on board with, but I haven't had that private conversation.
We've been talking about new bills in the state legislature that propose overhauling the way Michigan prosecutes and sentences juvenile offenders. Our guests today have been Republican State Senator Rick Jones of Grand Ledge and Kristen Staley, Associate Director for Youth Justice Policy at the Michigan Council on Crime and Delinquency. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR AM 870 every day, every weekday at 12 o'clock noon and always at WKAR.org. You may have read about the amazing find unearthed in a soybean field in Washtenaw County. A local farmer, Jim Bristle, discovered part of the rib cage of a woolly mammoth. Since then, Mr. Bristle's become something of a celebrity as hundreds of people have flocked to see the prehistoric relics. It turns out the timing of this find is pretty fortunate for Michigan historians, and current state's Kevin Lavery is here to tell us more. What's so coincidental about this news, Kevin?
Mark, you know how about 10 days ago NASA announced that they found water on Mars in the same week that the new Matt Damon film, The Martian, hit the theaters?
Right.
This is kind of the same thing here, a smaller scale. The discovery of the mammoth bones comes as the Michigan Historical Center is presenting its annual Michigan Archaeology Day this Saturday. And as luck would have it, one of the things on the program is a presentation about mammoths and mastodons. And according to the center's director, Sandra Clark, yes, there is a difference.
One of the things that we like to try to give kids and adults, for that matter, is an idea of just how big these things were. And you think about hunting these things when all you have is stone tools that you can throw. And so over here, we've got on the floor some mastodon footprints, and this is just one stride of the mastodon, so I'd have to jump really far just to get the spread between the hind feet. But it's also got a little facts, like the fact that they're 10 feet tall, they weigh 5 to 6 tons.
Okay, I'm thinking about Cro-Magnon man or whoever was around during this time. Okay, let's be generous. 180 pounds, 6 feet tall. We're going to be real generous.
You're real generous.
Oh, I know. Up against a 5 or 6 ton mammoth here, who went extinct first?
The mammoths went extinct first. And we don't know how they were hunted. The archaeologists that are doing a lot of this work are starting to see a pattern of, when we find these skeletons, they're often in ponds or very wet areas. So we're kind of thinking that maybe they, once they had the mastodon, they actually put it in these ponds to preserve the meat. Because a mastodon could feed your family and your village for a long time if you had one.
We're talking with Sandra Clark, the director of the Michigan Historical Center in Lansing. We're seeing a lecture happening over here, so just a busy day at the museum.
Actually, what you're seeing over there is a special program on voyageurs. And if we don't get away by the end of the program, you'll hear a rousing chorus of Alouette coming out of them as they paddle their canoe.
Well, that's a good enough segue as any to the Griffin, which is one of the most celebrated archaeological stories of the last few years in Michigan. And that will be part of the program on Saturday, the supposed claim of the finding of the wreck of the Griffin. Take us back to the late 1600s, Sandra. What was happening with the Griffin?
Well, the Griffin is a ship that LaSalle built to bring furs back to the East Coast. And it's the first ship on the Great Lakes. Unless I use the word ship, it's not a canoe. Obviously, Native people had a lot of transportation on the Great Lakes, but this is the first one on the Great Lakes. Built at Niagara, they bring it up through the Straits of Mackinac. They load it up with furs and send it back, and it never makes it back.
Somewhere in northern Lake Michigan, it met its fate.
That is what we expect. There are no reports that it passed the Straits of Mackinac. That doesn't mean it didn't, but likely is someplace in northern Lake Michigan is where it met its fate.
So we fast forward to 2015. Actually, I think it was last year, if I'm not mistaken. A couple of archaeologists, underwater explorers, claim they found what could be the Griffin.
Yes, or a part thereof. And on Saturday, Dean Anderson, who is the state archaeologist, is going to present his view of what they found and some thoughts about the Griffin, both the history of the Griffin and the likelihood that it still exists. And, this is the most publicized one, is the one everyone has heard about, but every year someone thinks they've found the Griffin.
We're talking with Sandra Clark, the director of the Michigan Historical Center in Lansing, about Michigan Archaeology Day coming up on Saturday. I also understand one of the exhibits is about a little more recent history, 20th century Michigan archaeology. Looking around this room, Sandra, there's a lot of young people here who were born in this particular century, and the 20th century is probably very old for them.
That's right. But we do have a presentation on the archaeology that's been ongoing on Michigan State University's campus. And again, all these books and things have been written about Michigan State. How could you learn from archaeology? Well, nobody writes down in the books what the kids had in their dorm rooms 40 years ago. And sometimes at archaeological sites, you can figure that out. So that's archaeology doesn't stop when we start getting paper and photographs. It continues because it often tells us different things and brings a different perspective.
Sandra Clark is the director of the Michigan Historical Center in Lansing, and we've been talking about Michigan Archaeology Day 2015 coming up on Saturday. Sandra, thank you.
You're welcome. I hope we have lots of folks here.
If it's like today, I think you'll be all right.
Yes.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Every Wednesday on Current State, we bring you Neighbors in Action, a look at area organizations working to make Greater Lansing a better place. Haven House in East Lansing provides emergency housing and support services for homeless, one-parent and two-parent families with children. The shelter helps families prepare for permanent housing by developing and promoting self-sufficiency, stability, and financial responsibility. Here to talk to us about Haven House is Executive Director Angie Mayu. Angie, welcome.
Thank you.
Along with Carla, a former resident at Haven House. Hi, Carla.
Hello.
Angie, what's the most important service that you feel Haven House offers homeless families?
I think the most important thing is being able to keep families all together, that families don't have to be split up to go into shelter, that they can come in as a family unit, because at other shelters, fathers aren't able to come in with their children. Mm-hmm. So if you're single dad, that's an issue. If you're two-parent family, you really depend on the support of that other adult. And also teen boys are split up from other shelters. The families have to be split up. So having everybody able to come in during that crisis and be together and work together as a team is really important for them.
Haven House has been around since 1983. How have your services changed over that lengthy period of time?
You know, the founders had a good idea when they started, and we haven't changed much of the programming, but have expanded it. We now work with families in their homes after they move out of our shelter into their new home, to help them with the stability and getting straight with them. So we'll work with them for up to 6 months there. We provide a lot more activities for the children and the families together while they're there so that it's a positive experience and not something that they look back on and don't want to remember, but that they leave and they had a good experience while they're there, even though it was a crisis situation.
Mm-hmm. Carla, tell us the story of how you found Haven House.
Well, when I first relocated to Lansing, I stayed there previously with my family, my husband, and my children. And it was a safe haven for us. It was safe. It was clean. We were able to find employment. And, I mean, it was just a good place. I had to go recently because I separated from my husband. And it was also a good experience. They also helped me find permanent housing.
Stability.
Yes.
Safety, security, the important components, I would imagine. How long have you stayed at Haven House altogether then, Carla?
The first time I was there for about 2.5 months. And the second time was close to 2 months.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of things, though, go a little bit deeper with us. What kinds of things did Haven House provide, the services that were really the biggest help to you and your family?
They gave leads on housing. They also gave leads on employment. They even have the transitional housing program where they come in and they assist with personal care needs. They give stuff for the kids for schooling and Christmas.
A lot of key services.
Yes.
We're talking with Carla, a former resident of the East Lansing homeless shelter Haven House, along with Executive Director of Haven House, Angie Mayu. Angie, do families have to apply or meet particular requirements to stay at Haven House?
Their only requirement is that they have children and that they have custody of those children. So we're not able to work with domestic violence issues, though, because we're not a safe place in that sense. Mm. But anything, just a family who has hit a hard time. And like Carla was saying earlier, she was able to come in with her husband. She has older boys that were able to come in, so they were all able to stay together, which was really important. Like the first time she came in, her and her husband worked really hard together as a team to get the kids to school and then to go look for housing. They were able to, you know, sort of divide and conquer together.
Gotcha.
So it
sure
was nice.
What couple hasn't done that?
Yes.
What couple with kids hasn't employed the divide and conquer strategy? And after they leave, I gather you're staying in touch with them after they leave and providing services.
Yes. Like Keller was saying, she's been in her own housing now for a year. We were just talking. But we were able to continue to meet with her go out to the house and bring out those personal care items. So a lot of times their income's pretty low, and most of that, 80% of it, will still go towards housing. So it's difficult to buy laundry soap and bleach and shampoo, those kinds of things. So we continue to help them with that as we're going out to the house too, to make sure that all the needs, you know, the kids are clean, so everybody in public knows they're taking good care of their kids. The house is clean, so the landlord knows that they have all of those things available to them.
Understood.
And can keep up.
We're talking about Haven House in East Lansing here on WKAR's Current State. It's our Neighbors in Action segment, which comes your way every Wednesday. Angie Mayhew is Executive Director of Haven House. We're also talking with Carla, a former resident at Haven House. Carla, I understand you were able to go back to school and get a nursing degree. What does achieving that goal mean to you?
It's exciting. Now I feel like I won't have to struggle anymore. Hopefully the struggles win.
Do you feel like the time at Haven House actually played a significant role? Was that a significant factor in enabling you to pursue the nursing degree?
It was definitely a motivator. Because I didn't want to get back in that situation again. So yeah. I knew I had to do what I had to do to get it done.
Yeah. Angie, how would you characterize the city of East Lansing's ability? I don't mean city government here necessarily, but how would you characterize East Lansing's ability to help the homeless?
Well, I think that a lot of times we think that we see only the homeless in downtown Lansing. You can drive through there and see an array of guys out. In East Lansing, you can drive through on early in the morning and see several of the guys here in the town. And some of them, when we talk about them in the larger group, they have areas or there used to be a guy that when I would drive in on Friday mornings, Thursday night's the big night in East Lansing here for fun. And he had an arrangement with several of the fraternities. He went in the morning and picked up all the cans and was making money that way. Mm. So I think that it goes across every boundary in our state, let alone our county. And there's always things that people can do, whether they want to volunteer at one of the agencies to assist, donate things that homeless families or individuals would need. Summer or winter's coming, and we're all going to be scrambling for gloves and hats and mittens to keep people warm as either they're out on the streets or traveling by bus. So there's lots of things that people can do to get involved.
Where can they learn more about your organization if they want to get involved?
Sure. We have our website, which is havenhouseel.org. We're also on Facebook, and we post lots of immediate opportunities or immediate needs on the Facebook page. But on our webpage, it gives you some more information about the programs, what we do, and how to volunteer.
Mm-hmm. How much stability do you feel there is in your life right now, Carla?
Right now, I feel like I can see.
You're employed, right?
You're recently got employed again, yes.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Oh, yes. So it's looking up.
The light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes.
Yeah. Are there any popular misconceptions, Angie, as to who is homeless? You referred to single guys or guys a minute ago. Are there popular misperceptions in play?
I think there is. I think a lot of people think of homeless as what they see on TV, or if they're driving through a big city, the guys on the side of the street, people with signs. The average age of a homeless person in Michigan is 9 years old.
Mm.
So I think a lot of people think that it's the 50 to 70 year old male that is homeless, when really
that really puts it into a different perspective, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Average age 9. My goodness. Well, this has been a great segment. It's been great to have both of you here. We've been talking with Haven House Executive Director Angie Mayhew and Carla, a former resident at Haven House, about the important work that they do. Best of luck, Carla. Thank you, Angie.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for our Neighbors in Action feature. Please help us out and email us your suggestions to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line, please, or tweet us at KAR Current State and tell us a little about why you think they should be featured for the important work that they do. That's our show for today. We follow today's discussion on prison reform tomorrow with another this weekend in Jackson. Former prison inmates will meet with concerned citizens and others to discuss prison reform. Current State Scott Pohl talks with Christine Peterson of the Jackson Area Civil Rights Awareness Association and Hakeem Crampton, who spent time in a Wisconsin prison before moving back to Michigan. Also, we'll hear from the music director of the New York Philharmonic, Maestro Alan Gilbert, about the orchestra's three-day residency this weekend at the University of Michigan, including conducting 1,000 performers during halftime at Saturday's Michigan-Northwestern game. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Current State's executive producer is Peter Worf. April Van Buren directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. We're available as a podcast on your smartphone every day. Subscribe, please, on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget we're on Facebook as well. Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. We hope you have a great day, and we hope to see you Thursday. It's Current State on WKAR.